This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, I'm delighted to have in the studio, back here with me, Luis Rodriguez, the poet, essayist, novelist, and memoirist. His first memoir, Always Running, was a national sensation, and now he's brought his own story up to date with an intensely frank and gripping book entitled It Calls You Back, An Odyssey Through Love, Addiction, Revolutions, and Healing. Luis Rodriguez, I have to say, is also a columnist for The Progressive, which we're very happy about. Luis Rodriguez, welcome to Progressive Radio.
You know what? It's my pleasure. I'm glad I can come back.
It's great to see you again. And it was great for me over the last day and a half to whip through this memoir of yours, which I highly recommend to anyone who's listening right now. It Calls You Back. This is going to grab you as a reader because it is such an intense personal look at struggling through what it means to be in a gang and then overcoming addiction and doing political work and then having some problems recapitulated in your own family. I don't know how you dealt with that. Why did you decide to dive back in here?
You know what? It's a very difficult subject, but in all the work that I do, I found that domestic abuse was a big issue with almost all gang kids, especially the women, molestations, things that we don't want to talk about. And I felt that I needed to bring out at least my own story to help bring light for everybody. Now, I wouldn't do this just to hurt my dad or my family. There's no purpose in that. It either heals or helps, or I wouldn't do it.
You know? Well, let's talk about your dad a little bit. You wrote an essay for The Progressive about your father a couple years ago, which I loved, and we reprinted in the best of The Progressive over 100 years. It was a story about your father as someone who accepted the American dream, the wrong American dream. Explain that.
Yeah, you know, I think when he came from Mexico, like a lot of people, they bought into this materialistic end of capitalism. And it's a really weird thing to do. Most people don't do that, but he did. He completely became a Republican, which is really rare in the Mexican community. And he was just a right-wing guy. But my understanding is that in Mexico, he was more left-leaning. It's really weird. But he comes over here, now he's all this. And then when I became politically active, he was really enraged. He was upset. He was trying to convert me back to something. And I fought him every step of the way. And I don't mean in a bad way, but I argued and argued with him. And it just wasn't working. We weren't able to speak anymore about
and things. Your mom didn't care for your politics either?
No, my mom was very much supportive of him, and it's really interesting that they were like that. But it helped me in many ways. Me fighting my dad and my mom in the politics helped me reframe and make that politics real for me. You know how that goes,
right? But you also were able to become independent in some way early on politically.
Yeah, and I think because I was independent personally in the streets, it kind of helped that, I kind of had to grow up myself, which is good and bad. There's bad to not being guided and making a lot of mistakes. But the other side of it teaches you to have to really stand on your own, make your own decisions. And like I say in the book, own your life. Whatever wrong I did, whatever good I've done, I own it. It's me,
And the ownership comes through in this book, It Calls You Back, by Luis Rodriguez, my guest today. But I was astonished then and horrified to read more about your father.
Yeah.
And you talked about child abuse. How did that secret come out?
Well, it came out when I was an adult. I didn't know this was going on. I wasn't at home. My sister, my youngest sister, was the first one to open up that door. And she paid a big price for it. She suffered for it. People went after her. I never witnessed my dad do anything. I'm very clear in my book that I did not witness this. I don't know personally that he did this. I'm telling my sister's story, really, of anybody. And, of course, the whole family knows he did it. The police did arrest him, and they left him in the care of my mom. So we do know that he actually did some things. How far and how deep is hard to know because none of my other family members would talk about it. So my sister's the only one. And when I met with my family just before the book came out, she called me the day before and says, whatever happens, tell the story.
There is power in just telling the truth.
I think it's important. And again, you got to be responsible for it. Telling the truth, but also how. to disparage my dad is not a purpose. It's more about if my dad's going to leave a legacy in this world, unfortunately, it's a bad one, but there's going to be some good out of it. That people can pick up what we need to know, that some of these people do these things are not the monsters. They're not the guys that are scarred and kidnap you and torture you. These are your family, people you love, people you trust. That's where a lot of the abuse is coming from.
Makes it more painful on top, probably. Yeah. How did you summon the generosity to tell your father at the end that you loved him in that last conversation you were writing this book?
You know what? It's very hard to imagine, but I guess I felt instinctively that if I hated him and carried that hate, it would poison me. It had nothing to do with him. And maybe because in spite of the terrible things he did and me arguing with him, you love your dad, man. You know, you love your mom. You know what I'm saying? So ultimately, it was like, I'm really sad for him, and I'm sad for the world that we're in, but guess what? I love you, Dad. I mean, that's all you can do. It actually helped me, my own personal healing. I kind of forgave him in my own way. I'm not going to let him off the hook about what he done, but I'm not going to tear into him and make him the monster that, you know, he was actually a very nice guy to the world. But I had to reconcile myself that this is the dad that I have, good and bad.
How important is it, do you think, for adult children to reconcile themselves with their parents, even though they've been through a lot of troubles?
I think it's important because here's what happens. The parents wound you very deeply. And if you don't really find a way to reconcile some level, those wounds take you through a lot of nonsense. You start wounding your own kids. You don't even know you're doing it. And I think it's important for you to reconcile something. Certain healing has to happen from what your parents do. And forgive yourself more than anybody else. And then make sure you don't do the same thing to your own kids.
One of the hearts of this story, It Calls You Back, is the story of your own first-born son, yeah. Ramiro. And he had some of the same troubles you had as an adolescent in gangs. Yeah. And how painful was it for you to see him going through that?
Well, you wouldn't want to, and you wouldn't want to see your kids go into this. And I barely survived it, and I never really told him the story, and I thought maybe, because I never told him, he wouldn't get into it. But, you know, he still got, he imagined that life. He idealized it like a lot of kids, and maybe he idealized me in a certain sense. I had a hard time with it, trying to get him out of the gang. It wasn't working, but I had a hard time trying to deal with it.
I mean, this part of it was a time that, you know, Always Running was out. He could read your story. He knew what you had been through.
Yeah, and yet it wasn't really sinking in. And it took a while for him to finally get it. A big prison sentence, some shootings, you know, just terrible things had to happen before my son finally woke up to what I was trying to do and what he needed to do.
And you write about that in that book. What was he eventually sent to prison for?
Well, 3 counts of attempted murder, including against 2 police officers. And this is very hard. In the state of Illinois, if you shoot a police officer, it's almost automatic 20 years to life per officer. And somebody told me, I don't know for a fact, that he might have been the only one in the state of Illinois to have shot at police officers and not do a life sentence. So it's amazing. But he got 28 years, which is an extraordinary amount of time.
Speaking with Luis Rodriguez about his latest memoir, it's called It Calls You Back, An Odyssey Through Love, Addiction, Revolutions, and Healing. I'd love it if you could read this little 3 paragraphs you wrote about what it was like for you as a father to have to counsel your son to take that 28-year sentence that was offered in an arrangement with the judge. Why don't you set it up and read it?
Yeah, he was being offered 28 years versus him going to trial and do 40 years to life. And for some reason, he didn't want to do it. He says, it's the same thing. I had to convince him that it wasn't. And that's very hard. And so I'll read this little passage. Let me say now, no parent should ever have to convince their child to take 28 years instead of going to trial and ending up with 40 years to life. This was one of the hardest things I'd ever done. I was convincing my son to take a sentence that for him, in his world, was not just. A problem was that a part of me thought I should be doing some of Ramiro's sentence. I couldn't take full responsibility for what Ramiro did. He had to own this. But a major reason why my son was in bad shape, why he raged so much and felt lost, was due to my own neglect for parenting, my drinking, my focusing on work instead of family, always something else over Ramiro. And I thought of his mother who also made terrible mistakes. Then there were the drunken husbands and abusive boyfriends in schools that pushed him away and police officers and psychiatric hospital staff who beat on him and rival gang members who tried to kill him. Ramiro was in a constant state of high alert, a reaction to previous trauma and neglect. I also thought of the deteriorating economic and political realities we all lived in, enacting daily tragedies of this caliber or worse, creating many Ramiros. Yes, my son pulled the trigger. Yes, he almost killed people. He almost had himself killed. He had to feel the weight of what he'd done. I couldn't take that away from him. But it wasn't just Ramiro's hand holding that gun that day.
Hmm. That's Luis Rodriguez reading from It Calls You Back, his memoir subtitled An Odyssey Through Love, Addiction, Revolutions, and Healing. Ramiro got out after serving about half.
Yeah, 13 and a half years. He's been out for a year, and I have to tell you that he's doing very well. He's really amazing. I am very proud of him. It's very hard. He's been institutionalized in prison. A total of 15 years since he was age 17. But now he's trying to get his life together. He's trying to recreate family the way he sees it. He's given up gangs and drugs. He was even counseling gang kids. So he had like 100 gang kids he was working with. So I'm really glad that he's doing well right now. It makes it all worthwhile after everything we went through to see him at that state, because you never know what would happen to your son, you know.
And he has a beautiful statement then later in that book. Do you want to read that too?
I asked him to write something as soon as he got out, and this is his statement. I've had over 13 years of psychological warfare. My mind has been a battlefield with many casualties, disconnections, reconnections. Everything's new. It feels good to see my kids, my family, and everyone who has supported me. It feels good to know that on my next journey of life, I don't have to do it alone. This is a new journey for everybody. All the hardships, the struggles were not just my own. While I did time, everyone else did life. As I stepped out the prison door and saw my family and friends standing in front of me, I didn't want to look back. Behind me was dissolution. In front of me was absolution. Now I'm going forward, taking advantage of all my support, not afraid to ask for help when we need it. For too long, I was trying to do everything alone. I was selfish and weak, full of pain and full of pride, holding on to so much anger, never knowing what I was truly angry at. That's all over with. All that sadness and hurt, I wanted to be gone. I look into my children's eyes, and all I can do is smile. I wake up with a smile. I walk everywhere with a smile. I smile because I finally made it home.
Luis Rodriguez reading from It Calls You Back. It is a redemptive story, this memoir. Redemptive, doubly redemptive.
Yeah.
Your story is redemptive. His story is redemptive.
And I hope that that's what people get. I want people to realize that every human being has great potential. We got great potential to do terrible things, but the potential, even among those, to do great is there. And a lot of times, all it takes is family, resources, community, people stepping into their lives in the proper way. You know what I mean? Providing people the sense that they matter and what they do matters. I hope that this is what people get out of this book.
This idea that everybody has redemptive possibilities is comes through in an essay you wrote recently for The Progressive about why life without parole is too extreme a sentence, and a sentence that is cruel and unusual in its own way. I learned something from that essay. I didn't realize that a lot of this is unusual, that most advanced industrial countries don't, and a lot of developing countries
don't
have life without parole, that 30 years, 40 years, but they don't put people away forever.
Yeah, even,
what's wrong with life without parole? Because people will say, well, it's better than the death penalty.
I think it's another death penalty. It's really what it is. You still couldn't come out, as one of the prisoners told me, in a coffin. And it just means you're writing off human beings, just writing them off. I contend that if for most crimes, and this is the vast majority of criminals, they don't have to do more than 3 or 7 years if they're properly rehabilitated with resources, treatment, whatever they need. Obviously, there's some people that are going to need some help and everything else, but to just write the people off, especially when they're young, you know how many young kids, juveniles, are being tried and given life without possibly parole. We're the only country in the whole world that does this. It's really amazing that we're still thinking about these kind of things.
Now, you said your son's done counseling of gang members. You've done a lot of that, including in prisons. What's that you do? Writing workshops in prisons? What else do you do?
I do everything from writing workshops to talks to healing workshops. I've been in prisons all over the country, and now I've even gone to prisons in Mexico, Central America. I was in England. I was at Her Majesty's Juvenile Detention Institute, something like that. It was like, you know. But I do it because I find that, again, I have to give back. I've been very blessed to get out of some terrible situations when I was a kid, and now I have to give back to those who haven't been that blessed, who are still going through some terrible things, especially now that we've had the highest incarceration rate in the world.
One of the redemptive tools you talk about in this book is art, is writing. You know, a lot of, sometimes it's almost a cliche, a writer says, you know, writing saved my life, but it actually happens. How does that happen?
And you know, what happens is, especially in prisoners, if they have an outlet to express, to connect with something deep inside them, they have a healing path. Art is a practice that if you keep doing it, will eventually get you to realize your own capacity. And to me, this is what I use in my, I have a cultural space called Tia Chucha Centro Cultural. This is what we do for the whole community. Totally arts. I have from gangsters to regular folk. I have from little kids to elderly. We bring it to the whole community because I really believe in the power of the arts, but in the power of shaping your life and shaping the world around you. That to me is what's important.
And where is Tia Chucha Cultural
Center?
Well,
now I no longer live in Chicago, as you know. I'm now in back in Los Angeles, where I grew up. I'm in the San Fernando Valley, and this is in the Northeast Valley, which is used to be called the Mexican side of the valley. And I say used to because Mexicans are everywhere now. So, but anyway, we're there. It's a 500,000 population that does not have, or did not until we showed up, a bookstore, a movie house, art gallery, cultural space, until we opened up the space.
Mm. I'm speaking with Luis Rodriguez, the author of It Calls You Back. Previously, he was the author of Always Running. He has some prize-winning poetry and novels under his hat as well. Mm-hmm. And he runs this cultural center in Southern California. That must be hard going, though, isn't it?
It is. It's hard times. People don't, you know, the times like us, people want to cut the arts. They want to cut these things that I think are vital, but they're saying there's no money for it. I think it's a big shame and it's wrong. I think we need to put money in more neighborhood arts, get people to feel that they can regenerate through their own capacity to imagine. To me, this is what really what we're teaching.
You had mentioned a little bit earlier in talking about your son, Ramiro, your own drinking, and the subtitle of your book mentions addiction. Talk to me about your addiction with drinking and how you overcame it or how you work on it.
Yeah, I've been sober for 18 years now, and a lot of it was when I woke up to my family that was suffering because a lot of it, I wasn't there. My oldest teenage kids by then were coming to me. I had a new family. They ended up with two young baby boys. And I was in the middle of this thing, and I was not there. I just, when you're drinking, when you're anything, drugs, it pulls you away. You know, after a while, it's like the drugs. You're only thinking about the next fix, or you're thinking about the next bar. A lot of functional alcoholics out there. I could work. I wrote Always Running. I did a lot of stuff. But then I was always thinking, man, I can hardly wait to that bar where I could escape. And I was the kind of guy that would drink until I passed out. I couldn't really just drink two or three beers. It was wrong, and I couldn't be there for my kids. I finally had to wake up to my own responsibility there for my children and my family and my community.
It's interesting because early on when you were doing political work after you got out of gangs, when you were a young man and were invested in some radical politics, you had forsworn everything.
Yeah.
And you didn't get back on hard drugs, but it was alcohol.
Yeah, and in fact, I justified the drinking by saying, well, at least it ain't heroin, it ain't all this hard drugs. It was wrong. I mean, obviously, it's better than to be on all the hard drugs. But the point was, it's just like, okay, everybody drinks, I can drink, and I kept drinking, and it was just my justification, you know. It's not that bad, you know. I just didn't let go of an addiction. That's the problem.
But you didn't do AA, right?
I didn't know AA. I tried. Actually, I flunked AA. I say flunked. I tried to go. It didn't work. I ended up going to another recovery program out of Chicago that was very helpful. But the real way that I went is into indigenous Native American spiritual practices. That was really the thing. That's what I do now. We have a sweat lodge in the San Fernando Valley where we bring in recovering addicts, gang kids, and it's open to the community. I don't proselytize. I'm not here to convert nobody. I tell people it's not even a belief system because you can come in there with Jesus, Buddha, Muslim, or if you're an atheist, you can still come in there. We don't make that the issue. The issue is that we make a community, and we have healing, and we utilize old, long traditions from this land.
It's interesting you mentioned atheism, Luis Rodriguez, because you say early in your book that you took the atheist path. You had a sister who tried to make you born again, as she was. And you abandoned that. But then you got into spiritual Native American spiritualism.
Much later, talk about that. I call it the godless path to the mystery, you know, because I think that I had a hard time with institutional religion. I felt that it was very abusive, the groups that were trying to convert us. I just, you know, of course, I'm not against anybody who's whatever religious their belief is, but for me personally, it just didn't work. It didn't speak to me, so I gave it up. And basically, the bars became my spiritual church. That's where I went. When I finally recovered, I realized that's a part of me that's missing. But I didn't want to fill it with just a bunch of things. I had to have it rooted in my own culture. My mother's Rarámuri native from Mexico. I spent a lot of time with Native reservations, and I realized I need to reconnect to my people, which is the first peoples of this land. And this is where I went. But again, I'm not trying to convert nobody. This is just my own thing that's helped me a lot. It's open. It's a kind of spirituality that's very open and doesn't go against science, doesn't go against any of the things that I think are important. You know what I mean? It's not like some people use spirituality against the rest of the world. No, this is a spirituality that aligns itself with whatever we're learning as human beings.
And is it easy for people to connect when they come to those?
Yes, it is, because we use now gang programs send kids to us, recovery programs, battered women's shelters. We have people come to us. We do a lot of healing work now, and it's free. We don't charge nobody. There's nobody making money. When I do the ceremonies, I don't charge nobody. In other words, we're doing it out of the love of ourselves and our community.
Luis Rodriguez, if someone's listening who's got a loved one in gangs, what would you tell them?
You know, I always tell them there's five things that you got to help them with. One is to help them find their art. Very important. Everybody's got some art, some passion, something they're into. Two, that they find a community, even if it's temporary, even if it's two or three people that will help them, that can really give them resources and whatever. Three, that they get a cause bigger than themselves. That was very important for me. Four, that they get spiritually engaged at some level. Doesn't have to be a big church, whatever they can get to. And then the fifth one is that, as the whole book ends up being, it's about owning your life. Learn to own your life. Be accountable to yourself and to others.
But that's the hardest one. That comes at the end, right?
Absolutely.
Now tell me about you getting a cause.
Yeah, I got very much involved with the Chicano movement. I got involved in the 60s and 70s when people were marching, were going against the war. One of my arrests actually was a protest against the war. They ended up turning against me because they ended up putting me in murderer's row for the people that died in this uprising. And it's just kind of goofy because I was a gangster. It's easy for them to say, well, you're a gangster. We're going to charge you for the murders. That's bad. But the fact that I stood up against the Vietnam War, the fact that I got actively involved really helped me with my changes, that there was another purposeful, meaningful life I could have and not just in the streets.
You know, it was amazing to me in reading It Calls You Back that early on there, when you were in jail or prison, some of the gang leaders recognized that in you. Yeah. And instead of making you choose the gang life, which seemed to be the customary road, they recognized.
I wanted to bring that in because people keep saying these gang guys are all bad news, they're going to kill you. You know, some of those guys recognized some things. And they saw that I was game for the gang, I was going to be trustworthy, I was going to come through. But they also saw something else that many ways they were saying, you have something we don't have. I don't believe that's true. You got smart, you love books. Of course they have it. But I really went with it, you know. And the fact that they recognized that helped me recognize it. Man, I should see that about myself. You know, other people were seeing it, and I wasn't. So, believe it or not, the gang leaders in those days were men of their word, which I can't say is true now. You know, things have changed a lot. But also that they could see, you know what, this is not your life. This heroin, this gang life, it's not really your life. And that was really important.
What is the gang situation like right now in the U.S.?
It's gotten tremendously bad, as you know, in the 80s and 90s. Things have gone down right now, but what's happened in the 80s and 90s was guns and drugs became central to gang life. It wasn't before. It was always there, but not like it is now. Three, the deindustrialization of America, jobs, millions of jobs gone in the inner city. Gangs became a way for people to have some kind of economic life. And then the fourth thing I think is terrible is that now we've imported the culture of gangs around the world. But more than that, we're deporting gang members, prisoners, in such large numbers that whole countries have been inundated with U.S.-based gangs like El Salvador, Guatemala, parts of Mexico, even Cambodia, Armenia. I'm hearing that U.S.-based gangs and people being deported, and they're bringing their culture out there. So we're really hurting the country, the world, when it comes to the situation with gangs.
So it's an export now?
It's an export that we bring out. U.S. is the gang capital of the world. We have more gang violence than any other country, and now we're deporting it to other places. They don't have resources, no jobs, and intense poverty. How can you have a place like El Salvador with so much poverty and war and then send thousands of gang kids there, sophisticated, tattooed, and think it's not going to impact a country like that?
I think a lot of people think gangs are being imported, though, from Mexico.
It's really a wrong way. It's not the right story. The story is really that we exported those gangs, and of course, now the drug cartels are very big in Mexico. They're utilizing the gangs that we exported to help do some of the murders and hits and robberies. So we're actually contributing, unfortunately, to what's going on in Mexico.
I'm speaking with Luis Rodriguez. He's the author of, most recently, It Calls You Back, An Odyssey Through Love, Addiction, Revolutions, and Healing. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at The Progressive. This is Progressive Radio. You recently went to Occupy Wall Street. In New York, what was that like?
Well, it was great. I really was totally amazed at the Occupy movement, the fact that all kinds of people, you know, when people say, well, it's all these white people, I'm glad. I'm glad that there's white, poor kids, young people. I'm glad it's people that normally you wouldn't think would be out in the street. It's time that America stood up. And it's not just people of color, and it's not just the pissed off radical people like you and me. It's regular people who are losing their homes, losing their jobs, and they're saying, I can't live no more. This is the big challenge to the capitalist system that I think we need. I hope it develops. I hope it gets shaped. I think we got to let it develop. I know people want to contain it, want to push it in different directions. I think we got to let it really breathe and find itself. But we also got to orient it as well. We got to be there. We got to be there to give it direction. We got to be there to give it whatever it needs so it can really move clearly and strategically against the very system that's cutting our throats. And I'm really glad that the people are stepping up in any way possible.
You wrote an essay that we're publishing soon in The Progressive about Occupy Wall Street called The Big Dream.
Yeah.
Say why it's important to have what that big dream is and why it's important to
have. Because, you know, I think for many, many years, people were just trying to survive and they were asking for the immediate demands. You know, collective bargaining, it's all good, jobs, homes. The big dream was, we don't even need an exploitative world. We don't need a world that can't provide jobs. The big dream is, why do we have a world that anybody has to be homeless? You know, so I think that's important that we begin to pull those things together, a big dream, a big vision, with all the immediate things that we need as a society and a country.
It's been a crazy kind of year with all the activism around the world. You saw it in the Arab Spring. There's all these protests in Europe over the bailing out the banks, just like they're bailing out here. And then we had what happened in Wisconsin, then Ohio, and a victory. Chile, the students are uprising. What's going on now?
Well, we're all globally tied, as you know. And capitalism is now everywhere, and now people are responding very similarly to what's happening in the world, in the country. And I'm glad that's happening, because we now realize that we're all one big, giant Titanic ship, and we're either going to build the lifeboats or we're all going to sink. And that's important. The whole world is beginning to move in one direction, and it's going to go against those systems that have been old, archaic, no longer has answers. And hopefully what I'm asking people to do and to trust is that people can imagine a better world of cooperation, of real resources, of proper relations with the earth and with each other. If we can start imagining that, we can create those kind of worlds that can align itself to that.
How do you build those lifeboats, though?
Yeah, I know. Well, it's going to take some struggle. It's going to take some difficult things. We have to go through them. I think that's where we're at. Taking the easy road isn't going to go.
Well, that's for sure. And it's been delightful having this time with you again. Luis Rodriguez, thanks for being my guest today.
Thank you.
Luis Rodriguez is the author, most recently, of It Calls You Back, An Odyssey Through Love, Addiction, Revolutions, and Healing. He's a poet, an essayist, a novelist, nonfiction writer. He runs the Tia Chucha Cultural Center in Southern California. Great to see you again.
My pleasure.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.